Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, August 14th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Boise fire doubles in size, plume visible from Eureka. Fire threat intensifies. Orleans resident shares experience living near the Boise blaze. And state superintendent urges public schools to restrict cell phone use in classrooms. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. The Boise fire in the northeasternmost portion of Humboldt County has doubled in size within the last 24 hours, now covering over 8,600 acres. Yesterday, its plume was visible from Eureka and Arcata, even as far south as Salmon Creek, causing concerns for local residents. However, the fire is over 100 miles away from Humboldt's city center, but only 4 miles southeast of Orleans.
Working my butt off trying to save our home we just got.
That was a resident who lives in Orleans.
My name is Trenton Peterson. I was born and raised out here in this area between Somes Bar and Orleans. So I have a lot of roots in this area. And it was just not even that many years ago, my father died actually in the Slater fire up in Happy Camp. That was 2021. So I've always kind of, since then especially, I've had kind of an awareness of fire. And then last year we had the Perch fire right outside of town. Now this year, there's the Boise fire, and it's close enough to really be threatening this beautiful chunk of property that I just bought for my family. So it's definitely a bit of an experience.
He stated that they are currently without fire insurance, which is a widespread issue for rural residents in Northern California. And having experienced another major wildfire where a member of his family passed, we asked how he is holding up.
It's scary. It's something that, unfortunately, I'm used to seeing, but it still is terrifying every time. It's fear, but it's determination as well. I'm not going to let the same kind of things happen if I can help it at all. It's something about us mountain people, we're very stubborn. We don't just back down. And although I'm scared, like I said, I'm determined to do everything I can. I'm up there today with a weed eater and a chainsaw, just clearing every bit of blackberry and brush and making it as fire safe as I possibly can. And talking to the fire crews, because they're actually using the road through the property as an access road, and trying to work as closely with them as possible so I can have an idea of what's going on straight from them.
At this time, over 600 personnel are assigned to the fire, and more resources have been ordered. Despite the Boise fire being the fourth largest wildfire currently active in the state of California, it has a low priority nationwide. But he stated that the crews he's spoken with are hopeful.
They're setting up a line on this end today with structure protection. They're actually getting engines and crews on the ground today and tomorrow. And for the last several days, we've been seeing them doing the retardant drops all along that ridge right outside of town. I actually have a bunch of family in fire as well. And a lot of them seem confident that it's not going to come into town, but it's still a very scary thing. I would say to always pay close attention, go on Facebook or whatever news source you have and make sure you are aware of the situation of what the fire behavior is doing. And if you have direct dealings with any fire crews, be as welcoming and as helpful as possible. Let them do their job and make it as easy for them as possible because they're there to save our homes.
The Forest Service has created the 2024 Boise Fire Facebook page, which shares regular updates throughout the day. Before news time, that Facebook page showed that the fire had grown on nearly all sides overnight, resulting in additional evacuation warnings and orders. Infrared radar showed that a significant slopover occurred on Forest Route 10N10H, which serves as a divider between Humboldt and Siskiyou counties. For more, KMA News reached out to Adrian Freeman, a Forest Service spokesperson on the Boise fire.
And what we're seeing is a what we would consider to be a fuels and topography-driven fire. What that means is we have this fire established in the Boise Creek drainage. It's a very large drainage. It hasn't seen fire in probably 80 to 100 years. That means there's very heavy vegetation loading. And because of the topography and those fuels, we are seeing active fire behavior, especially in the afternoon as the inversion lifts. And we get mixing of the atmosphere and warming temperatures above the fire.
Critical fire behavior was observed yesterday after the inversion layer lifted and the fire got into alignment with the Boise Creek drainage. The growth was primarily to the east, but residents from a 100-mile radius could observe the pyrocumulus cloud, which nearly reached the stratosphere.
Yeah, so what we had was not a lot of wind. And in a lot of ways, that's really good for fire spread, right? But what we saw was a huge amount of energy being generated from the fire as it chewed through that heavy vegetation. And as the smoke lifted straight up, creating a really impressive plume, topping out at almost 20,000 feet. Above the surface of the earth, which is exactly why it was totally visible in places like Arcata and Eureka.
When those plumes of smoke drop back into the troposphere, the lowest layer of the atmosphere, they can cause dangerous fire activity. However, she reiterated that this fire is not driven by wind or weather, but by the topography.
You know, there is convective activity in these large plumes, but we weren't looking at an unstable atmosphere. We were looking at, you know, quite a stable atmosphere. So at least at that elevation. So while we were seeing the mixing and the moving up, we were less concerned about that potential collapse as we would be potentially with that convective activity.
Today, to the east of the fire, the community of Forks of Salmon was put under an evacuation warning. The Forest Service announced that they will be working with the Salmon River Restoration Council and will be holding community meetings in that region, indicating concerns of the fire running miles to the east. However, there are multiple different fire scars in that path. The Perch Fire from 2023, the Red Salmon Complex from 2020, and the Butler Fire Scar from 2013, which may help slow fire activity.
The thing about it is, as I said, this is not a wind-driven fire. It's mostly a terrain and a fuels-driven fire. So what it's doing is getting in alignment with the big drainages that are here. And then fire absolutely loves to run through narrow spaces, and it loves to run uphill. And it's got a lot of vegetation to make that happen. So we're seeing that spread a lot because that's the alignment with the big drainages.
The Boise Fire is located in Karuk Country, and the tribe has been making history with their efforts to bring fire back to the landscape through prescribed and cultural burns. We asked if these techniques have been applied in that region and if the Forest Service will be working with Native firefighters and fire lighters on this incident.
Yeah, absolutely. And to answer your first question, where this is in the Boise Creek drainage has not seen a great deal of fuel treatment. It's extremely inaccessible. It doesn't have a lot of access points. And so it in general has not seen a ton of fuels treatments. Where there have been fuel treatments are around towns, around structures, in areas on, you know, along roads and places like that. And every bit of that is absolutely helpful in sort of lessening the intensity of fires like this. You know, I think we all know that we need to be restoring those natural fire return intervals in order to stop seeing these really extreme wildfires. So it's very evident that there hasn't been a fire in the Boise Creek drainage for what is probably an unnatural amount of time. However, trying to get fire into that area safely would be very, very difficult to do. So positive side, there's been a ton of work collaboratively from the tribes and the Forest Service, along with many other entities around here. And there really is a culture of understanding about fire and the critical nature of having fire in this ecosystem. That area, the Boise Creek drainage, is just a place that hasn't seen a lot of that hazardous fuels work because of the difficulty of access and all those other things.
The fire has been rapidly increasing in size, while the containment percentage remains at zero. We asked when we could see that change.
So a couple things. As long as we're in this weather pattern where we're seeing, the inversion lift and active fire behavior, and there's vegetation for this fire to go through, I think it's likely that we'll continue to see these periods of really active growth. Now, we do have extremely mitigated conditions coming up over the next few days, and that should really help us in starting to build containment lines and things like that. I mean, we're really blessed right now by the fact that it's only in the mid-70s. It's a lot easier for crews to work in those conditions. And it's just good for everybody. We're getting really good fuel moisture recovery overnight. And that's a really big deal. So we're seeing really positive conditions for firefighting. One thing I will say is that this team has been in this country a lot. And I don't think any of us are going to be overly eager to report containment until we are absolutely sure that a fire is going to stay within containment lines. So I think you're going to see us being very conservative about reporting containment. And that's because we just know in the steepness of this country, in the heavy timber, in the difficulty with the dry conditions and the dry fuels, it doesn't make sense to claim containment only to have it rethreatened.
As of news time, no structures have been reported as damaged or destroyed, despite yesterday's significant fire run. In today's operational briefing, the section chief with Team 10 stated that if there is a concern for property, crews would pull away from the fire line and focus on structure protection. Freeman elaborates.
Yeah, so it's a big deal. And a couple of things about structure protection, they are out in the community looking at structures. The other thing is that a very extensive structure protection plan was done during the Perch fire last year. So we are utilizing those map layers to make plans for structure protection. Now, we've had a lot of questions. Why isn't there an engine at my house? If we had unlimited resources, there probably would be, but we don't. We are actually fairly low in priority nationwide for resources, which feels sort of amazing given the size of fires that we've had. But in truth, places like the Great Basin and the Pacific Northwest have seen much more significant fire this year than we have, which feels amazing, I know. So we are actually doing really well with getting crews and getting engines and bringing those infrastructure protection as they get here. But it's going to take a while for us to build up those resources as they're coming off other incidents in California. So all that to say, there is structure protection in place. We do have a plan for structure protection, but you probably will not see an engine in every single house. And then, as far as evacuations are concerned, it is really critical that you're tuned into the evacuations and watching what's happening. And you're doing that from the official site. I got a call today from somebody who says, my house is not in the evacuation area on watch duty. Well, watch duty is not an official source of information. It's tempting to use it because it's fast. And actually, I have it on my phone, and every time I see a new fire, I look at watch duty to see what that fire is and where it is, what its name is, with its automatic map-based reporting. But the other things that come out of watch duty are from volunteer reporters. And some of them are excellent, and some of them aren't. So especially when you're talking about something as critical as evacuations, you really need to be tuned into the official site, and that would be your Humboldt County Sheriff's Office of Emergency Services, or your Office of Emergency Services, same with Siskiyou County, and get on those Code Red or Everbridge or Genesis programs that will alert you to when evacuations are happening in your zone.
Both Humboldt and Siskiyou counties use the same online evacuation app. You can find your zone and a list of the official areas under orders and warnings at protect.genesis.com. The Forest Service has also established a website that has a link to every official source you need to stay informed. That's www.linktr.ee/2024BoiseFireSRF. You can also email questions or concerns to 2024.boise@firenet.gov or call the public information line at 707-572-4860. As for what the next few days will look like in terms of fire growth and behavior, and if the fire could continue to double in size, she said,
"You know, I don't think I'd speculate because it totally depends what drainages it gets established in and aligned with. So I don't think I would actually speculate on that. I think it could. You know, I'm looking at it right now and it's not doing the extreme behavior that it was yesterday, although that was quite a bit later in the burning period. We also have some clouds mixed in with it, so that's good. But I don't think anything that a fire does out in this country would surprise me anymore. So I think stay tuned. I think that's the best thing. You know, that's hard in these communities where you're often out of cell service. You know, I know this is extremely frustrating for people who don't necessarily live in these communities but are watching this happen out in these rural areas. You know, stay tuned. Stay informed, and continue to follow those official sources."
A list of official links can also be found on KMUD.org. Just click the Fire Resources tab. You can also visit the KMUD News Instagram and Facebook to see photos of the fire and yesterday's pyrocumulus cloud. Our newsroom will continue to share updates. In state news, as students return to schools across the state this month, Governor Gavin Newsom and Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond are urging public school districts to follow the lead of Los Angeles Unified School District in restricting cell phone use in classrooms. KPFA's Audie McAfee reports.
Children all over the country are attached at the hip to their phones. But what if their education depends on not having them? At least until the school day is over anyways. That's what Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond and Governor Gavin Newsom are working towards after what they say has been a decline in the mental, scholastic, and social health of students over the past decade. In a health advisory released last year, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy warned that adolescents who spend more than 3 hours a day on social media are at risk of heightened anxiety and depression symptoms. And according to a PEW Research Center survey, 72% of high school and 33% of middle school teachers report cell phone distractions as a major problem. Governor Gavin Newsom sent a letter to school districts in the state this week, pushing them to restrict students' use of smartphones on campus. In the letter, he said as he works with the state legislature to further restrict the use of smartphones in schools, school leaders should act now. Previously, Newsom signed into law a bill introduced by Democratic Assemblymember Al Marzucci of Los Angeles South Bay and San Pedro that gave schools the authority to regulate the use of cell phones during school hours. A report by Common Sense Media found that 97% of students use their phones during the school day for a median of 43 minutes, which can be equated to a full class period. According to Governor Newsom's office, schools in districts such as Santa Barbara Unified, Bullard High in Fresno, and LA Unified have followed through with restrictions and seen positive impacts. He urged all other California schools to follow suit. Neither Governor Newsom's office nor Superintendent Thurmond responded in time for comment on this story. For KPFA Radio, I'm Audie McAfee.
In national news, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz made his first solo campaign appearance on Tuesday, just a week after being selected as the vice presidential running mate on the Democratic ticket. KPFA's Christopher Martinez shares this report.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is a longtime union member and supporter of organized labor, and the Biden-Harris administration has the reputation of being the most union-friendly administration in U.S. history. So Walz was on friendly turf when he spoke at the National Convention of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees in Los Angeles.
And as a dues-paying member of my teachers' union for years, let me just say thank you again for having a fellow union member here.
Walz focused on his and his running mate's commitment to raising up the working class, not a controversial issue for a union crowd.
So I know I'm preaching to the choir a little bit today, but the choir needs to sing. The choir needs to sing.
Walz blasted Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump for his attitude towards working people, in his actions as president, in his remarks at speeches, and in other realms.
You know, you can tell a lot about people in their personal lives. He spent a decade stiffing service workers from dishwashers, waiters, and carpenters on his own properties to enrich himself. As president, he cut overtime benefits for millions of workers, and he opposed any effort to raise the minimum wage. That's all you need to know. You don't have to ask twice. We know who they are.
He took particular aim at the controversial Project 2025, a detailed 900-page plan for a conservative presidency that was created by a team of former Trump administration officials and other supporters. Walz describes it as a to-do list, in his words, to put the screws to working people.
And make no mistake about this. Donald Trump and J.D. Vance want to eliminate AFSCME and all public sector unions altogether. Hell, they're even going after the 40-hour work week. Someone was joking and said, what's next, child labor? Oh yeah, that's in there too, by the way. Reducing the rules around our children, putting them into dangerous jobs again.
Trump has publicly distanced himself from Project 2025, but Walz is skeptical.
Trump's playing dumb. Oh, I don't know about 2025. Some of you heard this say it, because I'm not ever closing the yearbook on this. I'm a football coach at heart. And I'll tell you one thing I know for sure is, if you're going to take the time to draw up a playbook, you're damn sure going to use it.
He also took aim at Trump's vice presidential candidate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance.
And I'll tell you, his running mate, I don't know if that was a value add to this campaign or not, but he's one of four senators, four, that has never cast a vote on a pro-worker bill in his life. Not once. A stop clock's right twice a day. This guy can't get it right once. Not once. For workers.
Vance has attacked Walz in recent days over his service record from Walz's 24-year military career. It's a criticism Walz has heard before when he ran for Congress. It's also a form of criticism that has offended some veterans, but Walz brushed it off.
I'm going to say it again as clearly as I can. I am damn proud of my service to this country. And I firmly believe you should never denigrate another person's service record. To anyone brave enough to put on that uniform for our great country, including my opponent, I just have a few simple words. Thank you for your service and sacrifice.
Of course, it's not really a campaign speech if there's not a call to action. And Walz made clear the kind of action he expects from AFSCME, telling them, we have 84 days, we'll sleep when we're dead, we'll do the work now.
We got over 4,000 people in this room. We won states by less than 10,000 votes in some cases. And I don't know about you, and I know it, this is going to be a close, tough race. It is going to be a tough one. But if each of us does an extra shift, an extra hour, a little bit more, we get to wake up on that morning after the election and know that the work we did transformed the lives for millions, transformed generations.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In international news, the United Nations Security Council gathered to discuss an Israeli airstrike over the weekend that hit a UN school turned shelter in Gaza. KPFA's Scott Baba reports.
The nation of Algeria called for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council over an Israeli airstrike that reportedly killed at least 80 Palestinians over the weekend, one of the deadliest single attacks in the 10-month-old Israel-Hamas war. Rosemary DiCarlo, United Nations Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, said that the attack was indicative of the larger issues surrounding the war in Gaza.
The devastating Israeli attack on the El Tibon school in Gaza City, which prompted this meeting, points once again to the desperate need to reach a ceasefire, free the hostages, and scale up humanitarian aid to Gaza.
The Israeli military acknowledged it targeted the Tabin School in central Gaza City, saying it hit a Hamas command center in a mosque in its compound and killed over a dozen Hamas and Islamic Jihad fighters. Hamas, meanwhile, denied there were any militants in the school. Omar Benjama, permanent representative of Algeria to the United Nations, said that his country called the meeting in the hope that the governing body would take its responsibility towards enforcing international security seriously.
Has the legal and moral primary responsibility to act and to act firmly, to shoulder its mandate in preserving international peace and security.
The United States representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said that the United States was concerned over the reports of the Tabin School strike, while still defending Israel's right to defend itself.
Hamas continues to gather and continues to operate out of schools with no regard for the well-being of civilians. Israel has a right to pursue Hamas. Israel has a right to respond to threats. But how it does that matters. We've said repeatedly and consistently that Israel must take measures to minimize civilian harm.
Greenfield went on to argue that incidents like this strike are exactly why scheduled ceasefire negotiations proposed by the United States, Egypt, and Qatar are so important. Riyad Mansour, the permanent observer of Palestine to the United Nations, said that the killings over the weekend made it clear that Israel has no intention of listening to or obeying UN appeals or non-binding resolutions, and called on the United Nations to pass binding sanctions against Israel.
Stop imagining that you can reason with the Israeli government so it stops killing civilians by the thousands, imposing famine, torturing prisoners, colonizing and annexing our land. All while you appeal to them, call on them, demand them to stop. You have to tell them to stop, and you have the tools to make them stop as a Security Council and as nations in your national capacity.
Israeli Ambassador Gilad Erdan, whose country isn't a council member, excoriated the group for convening the urgent meeting about Saturday's airstrike and reiterated the Israeli position that the school had been a legitimate military target.
We targeted dangerous terrorists operating in a Hamas command and control center within El Tabain school. As usual, Hamas cynically abuses civilian facilities which should be protected as their terror bases. We neutralized dozens of vicious terrorists who used this school for their evil goals and were in direct violation of international law. But do you hold Hamas accountable for the losses? No, of course not.
But Representative Benjama of Algeria responded through a translator that Israel could not so easily push all the responsibility of its wartime actions off onto Hamas.
I wanted to testify here that the 16,000 children who have been killed since the 7th of October didn't kill themselves. I would like to testify here that the more than 10,000 women massacred didn't massacre themselves.
Speaking at a separate event, U.S. President Joe Biden said later that achieving a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is, quote, getting hard, but he expressed his resolve at securing an end to the hostilities. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Audie McAfee, Christopher Martinez, and Scott Baba. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send us an email to news@kmo.org. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.